conversation. Take a listen.
Avi, I'm delighted you could join me today for Rabble Radio to talk about some of the key issues you're involved in. You've been part of the UB Center for Climate Justice for 3 years now, and of course, many of us know you as an amazing documentary filmmaker over many decades. But today, I want to begin with your compelling work, calling out genocide in Gaza. In a recent powerful statement, and as part of the Jewish Faculty Network, and as a hopeful optimist, I would say, you tell us, quote, many historic changes are coming, as you also call out Canada for its dreadful complicity in mass starvation and war, cutting off funding to UNRWA. You ask, quote, can this country, Canada, ever again claim the role of honest broker, end quote. So tell us, Avi, about your work with the Jewish Faculty Network and what impact it has to confront the powerful Israel lobby in Canada that denies the atrocities we see before our eyes in Gaza.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Libby. I'm delighted to be here on Rabble Radio. Yes, I have been very immersed in this new front of my own public work since the genocide began after October 7th. And I do think that we're in a moment of kind of tectonic change. There are immense changes happening underneath the surface as this battle is still being fought. I mean, there are encampments that are still up and being taken down as we record this interview. And that whole new movement has just emerged in the last few months in response to this genocide, which grinds on day after day. I mean, it's hard to live in connection to the horror, which has never stopped. And I think this moment in the movement is important because it's so hard for people to sustain, you know, just a tangible understanding that genocide is still occurring hour after hour, day after day. So we're in an incredible historic moment. I have no doubt of that. One of the things that shaped it, I mean, this really is in some ways about the power of story. The story that the Zionist movement has been able to tell over, you know, almost a century, mm-hmm. about the reason for the state of Israel, the reason for all of its behavior towards Palestinians, which is now almost universally agreed, except for the Israel lobby, to be an apartheid system, not just an occupation, and now an ongoing genocide. That story is so powerful. And when you look at the Jewish community, there are many people who are still completely possessed by that story. But now, since October 7th, we have seen a whole new movement of Jewish people in Canada, the United States, and around the world who are saying, not in our name. This is not part of our tradition. When we say never again, we mean never again for anyone. And it is unbearably painful that a genocide is being committed in the name of keeping Jewish people safe, which of course it does the opposite. And so the Jewish Faculty Network, I was part of starting up a chapter at UBC. It's only been around for a few years. It was founded a few years ago, actually, to fight this IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, the International Holocaust Remembrance mm-hmm. Association definition, which the Israel lobby in all of its forms is pushing at every level, every government, every institution. And it's a definition of anti-Semitism that is exclusive, that is not needed or necessary to fight racism of all kinds and real anti-Semitism. And it makes the critique of the state of Israel susceptible to claims of anti-Semitism. So it's a very negative thing that the Jewish Faculty Network, scholars, experts in history and anti-racism and in colonialism and other related topics are standing up and saying, you know, we want to push back and give another identity for people in the Jewish community that does not agree with this relentless pro-Israel narrative. And look, my own tradition, my grandpa David Lewis, one of the founders of the CCF, came from the Bundist tradition. The Jewish Labor Bund was a political party, trade union, cultural and social movement in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Russia especially. And it was an anti-Zionist Jewish movement. It was started, Libby, in the same year, I think it was 1897, was the first council of the Jewish Labor Bund and the first meeting of the World Zionist Organization. So there have been these competing strains of Judaism, of Jewish political culture for a long, long time. And it's really amazing to see this flowering of Jews against genocide, Jewish voice for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices in Canada and the Jewish Faculty Network. And if not now, many, many movements that are really showing the diversity of opinions on Israel within the Jewish community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, just moving on from there, I know, Avi, you're deeply involved in the media and the impact it has on our lives. And, you know, many Canadians historically have relied on our publicly funded broadcaster, the CBC, to be a reliable source of news and analysis. I noted that you were recently part of an open letter to CBC concerning allegations of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism. Pretty heavy allegations. Mm-hmm. What caused you to sign on to this letter? Well, and many, many other filmmakers. And what's been the impact of the letter? Has it had any effect at CBC?
I think it has. I mean, look, this is part of an ongoing kind of generational battle to save the CBC from itself. It's, you know, it's a national tradition. It's our public broadcaster. And yet our relationship with it at this point in history is basically to yell at the radio. And I don't think even most of us even watch the TV news anymore because it's been so degraded. There have been so many cuts to the resources of the CBC. But more than that, there's been a declining culture of journalism within the CBC. I was lucky enough to work at the CBC in the late 1990s and early 2000s until the Harper era began in 2006, when suddenly I was no longer invited to host CBC shows, which for a long time I denied the causal connection there. But over time, I've come to realize that that was, in fact, the case. And it's emblematic of a very narrow bureaucratic approach within the CBC that tries to avoid complaints. And the irony of this, in a time when the right is determined, as it was in Harper's day, to defund the CBC, to destroy the network of information that binds all of our communities together across this large land, or that used to anyway. And they're constantly being accused of being like a communist front, these ridiculous allegations from the political right about the CBC. And in response, they bend over backwards not to give progressive voices, particularly on Israel-Palestine, fair share of the airwaves. And that wasn't the case in the late 90s and the early 2000s when I was on CBC. And Tony Berman, who was the head of news back then, an incredible journalist from the old school, just believed that the role of public journalism is to hold power to account and to represent a diversity of political voices and opinions and constituencies across the service. So in this situation, we had a CBC executive who was in a commissioning role in the documentary unit, which is a fraction, a tiny shadow of its former self, right? They don't spend money on documentaries anymore, but, you know, they buy independent documentaries for, like, I think a few thousand dollars after they've already been made and funded by others. They fund almost no independent documentary anymore. And this executive was posting from October 7th on horrifically anti-Palestinian racist social media posts and incredibly, like, Israeli Hasbara propaganda and really, really slanted perspectives in a complete violation of the CBC standards and practices, which were being applied against journalists in newsrooms to prevent them from even saying the word Palestine, you know, as we found in that incredible investigative report from The Breach, which had an inside story of a CBC produced news producer who quit in the months following October 7th. So here was this executive posting horrific things on their social media, and independent filmmakers were supposed to go and pitch films from a Palestinian perspective to this person. It was terrible. And so that started a conversation. This group of filmmakers and media makers, mostly racialized folks, went through a long internal process, many, many meetings. They went publicly only very reluctantly after pursuing every part of the official process and finally wrote this open letter. This executive is now no longer in a commissioning role in documentaries, but otherwise there's been no statement. That there are a number of demands that are very reasonable, that the CBC should affirm its statement against anti-Palestinian racism and its commitment to soliciting those voices and treating the issue fairly. We know it doesn't. And I'll tell you why, just briefly. You know, the pro-Israel groups, which are extremely well-resourced, they have all of these full-time, like hundreds of full-time staff and all this huge constellation of pro-Israel groups across the country, they exploit any complaint-driven mechanism. And the CBC has an ombudsperson and, like, you know, click here to complain culture. And so every single time there's a story on any platform, local radio, national news, whatever it is, about Israel-Palestine, they are flooded with complaints from the pro-Israel lobby, and they are constitutionally required, their own, you know, their own system set up, to respond to all those complaints. So half of that, you know, the seventh floor of the CBC building, the executive branch, is spending their entire lives responding to these pro-Israel complaints. And it slants the coverage, it slants the culture inside. And we on the other side, frankly, don't have the capacity to fight back on that level, except that the culture of the open letter and the petition, I sometimes wonder if we really think we're going to change the world with like another open letter or another petition. But actually, I think it's put pressure on the CBC. And they're starting, they're starting to hear the other side and try to accommodate. But we still got a big fight to fight there.
Yeah. And I think projects from like Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East who do their media accountability project follow up, you know, they're trying to counterbalance and push back. So there are good things happening. Well, Avi, I just want to move on to, I guess, more of your academic life and how that's intertwined with your activism. I'm curious to know how academic life is suiting you. You're an associate professor at the UBC Center for Climate Justice. And I have to say, you seem very able to weave your activism into academia, not an easy thing to do. For example, you did a recent event on the climate emergency and the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion here in BC, which has been a huge issue. So just tell us a little bit about how does your activism inform your teaching and particularly about the Trans Mountain Pipeline?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you calling it teaching rather than academia, because, I mean, I don't think it doesn't take a lot of Google searching to find out that I'm not an academic, you know. And I was actually amazed and delighted to be offered this position at UBC because I haven't followed a traditional academic career. And, you know, the valuing of another kind of, well, certainly, you know, it's interesting though, because like in the last federal election, you know that I ran for the federal NDP in the riding of West Vancouver, Sunshine Coast, Sea to Sky. And the role of academics in that election campaign in rating, and the CBC played a terrible role in this as well, by the way, by doing an article asking academics, who are basically liberal academics, to evaluate all the parties' climate policies. And they gave the Conservative Party's policy a higher mark than the NDP's. And it was shocking to me. I thought that the NDP climate policy was what could have been stronger. It should have been more serious and more detailed. But obviously, the Conservatives, who have, you know, still have large parts of their movement denying the reality of the climate emergency and have no plan whatsoever that's actually credible, no real approach to dealing with reducing our emissions and actually making corporations pay rather than workers, for them to be rated higher than the NDP was an outrage in the middle of an election campaign. However, the power of credentialism of academics, especially mainstream academics who insinuate themselves into institutions and into the powers that be, it's a real power in our society, the so-called validators, right, who come and say, here's my expertise and I'm putting it behind this baldly political position, right, that the liberals have the best climate plan. Wow, amazing. And I happen to be on their, you know, net zero advisory committee or whatever, right? So it's a powerful place in society. It's not a place I ever thought I would end up in. And for me, the incredible thing is being in the realm of teaching young people. It's a very powerful and moving time to be. I teach climate justice at the University of British Columbia. It's the first time climate justice has ever been taught as a standalone course. And we go deep into the roots of how the climate emergency was built by colonialism and the evolution of the capitalist system and the extractivist mindset. A system that sees everything as a commodity from which to extract value, both the natural world and human labor. And we go through greenwashing. We talk about what it'll take, whether the movement should escalate its tactics, whether what is a non-reformist reform. Like, it's really amazing to be with, I had 100 students last semester, with 100 young people who are losing sleep at night over the climate emergency and really get a chance to dig deeper into it, into the sources, into the causes, and into the implications. So it's been a blessing to be in that space. And it's also been a reality check that young people are dealing with a tremendous amount of anxiety and grief around the climate crisis and really want to find ways to engage and to be part of young people's journey from just stressing about it alone in front of their screens to connecting with other people, finding a way into all of the different parts of the climate justice movement and finding a path of principled activism in their own life. Like, that's what could be better. That's that for me, it's real purpose work. It speaks to why I'm here and what we can be doing. But at the same time, you know, I think it's part of a constellation of different approaches. And we're in a polycrisis with crises that intersect and solutions that need to intersect as well. And so teaching is like just one part of how I try to help make change in the world.
Well, it's a really beautiful connection, and I'm glad you're there. I feel good knowing that you're there teaching all of those young people and that you're weaving them into activism as well. So before we leave off today, I can't help but reference the diversity of your life's work: activist, filmmaker, teacher, and also political candidate. As you mentioned, you ran in the last federal election. I think people will be curious to know why you've chosen this as a path to change. You've confronted the rise of right-wing politics in Canada. What situates you in this moment, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I mean, you know, I come from a political family. In the 1970s, when I was growing up, my dad, Stephen Lewis, was the leader of the Ontario NDP, and my grandpa, David Lewis, was leader of the federal NDP for the same time. So, like, I come by my Nepo baby status, you know, legit. It's not an inheritance of wealth and power. It's an inheritance of struggle and resistance and defiance of capitalism and of the system of inequalities in which we live. However, it took me almost 55 years to get to the starting line in terms of electoral politics. And I think, you know, I came of age in the 1980s and 1990s. In this period when, from Reagan and Thatcher, you know, to neoliberalism with a progressive veneer under Krachin and Martin and now Justin Trudeau, we have been in an incredible narrowing of political freedoms, of economic freedoms and justice and equality in our societies. I just finished reading The Galleys for Charlie Angus's book about the 1980s and his journey as a kind of punk politician, punk musician turned punk politician. And it really is true that the dynamics in place today were laid down in the 1980s. In the 1980s, when austerity and, you know, the withdrawal of our federal government from healthcare funding, from housing, social housing, from transportation, all of the crises in all of the different parts of our lives, including and especially the cost of living crisis where people cannot afford to buy groceries and are paying way more than half their income in rent in so many situations, are all traced back to the withdrawal of government support for these vital areas of our life. That's been going on my whole lifetime as an adult. And I pursued my mom's path rather than my dad's in my first career in journalism, because it seemed like the public sphere and the public debate and the way that the discourse, you know, unrolls in the story of our age seemed to be the place that mattered more than the political class, which already in the 80s and 90s seemed pretty captured by corporate interests. But at a certain point, and my journalism was always around social movements, both globally and locally and nationally. And after, you know, 3 decades of doing that kind of work of storytelling in support of and in solidarity with social movements, I just came to a conclusion that we are losing on the outside and the inside, but that the people who go into the political system have to leave their social movement connections and get swallowed up inside this bubble. And on the outside, we're raging sometimes at our former comrades who go into the system. And Libby, this is your story too. And you're one of the very few politicians, I would say, in the half a century in Canada, who came out of a social movement context, went into the inside and remained as a bridge between those two worlds. And, you know, just in these recent years of my life, I've come to the conclusion that I think I can play a role in being a movement accountable electoral figure if I can get elected, and that we need more of a nexus between that outside power and those inside representatives and politicians who actually feel accountable to social movements and not to their party structures exclusively or to the political class or to their own, you know, established power or pension, whatever else, right? It really is about building inside-outside power. And there's lots of activity in social movements always. And I think this incredible time of an emergence of a whole new social movement against genocide in Gaza has, you know, I think we're still in the midst of understanding this historic change and the emergence of this new movement. I hope it's a ballot question in the next election. I don't know if it will be, but I know it will be a force of all of these organizations at the grassroots that are want to play a role in the political process. But we still don't have enough people on the inside. And I think that, you know, there are some fantastic NDP MPs who play that role. And there are some who are leaving And we need a new, we need to refresh the NDP's connection to movements because, you know, I have on my bookshelf always a copy of my grandpa's book from 1944, Make This Your Canada, which was a kind of popular version, a huge bestseller, by the way, a popular version of the CCF platform as the Second World War came to an end. And it expressed movement values in the political sphere, proposing that the government use all of the public ownership and other techniques that it used to fight fascism in Europe as a template, as a blueprint for how to fight poverty and inequality in Canada. And in the 1940s, they talked about the 1% and the 99%. And that was a time, you know, when the CCF was very much a movement party. And as we live through the rise of fascism again, we see Poilievre, you know, hanging out with Diaghilev and cultivating a mainstream face for an extreme right-wing agenda, which will be an utter nightmare in this country if it comes to power. We see what's going on in Europe. We see what's going on south of the border. A year from now, we may be living with, you know, crypto-fascist parties in charge in large parts of the industrialized world. And so that fight, very much like the 1930s, is on the move right now. And I think the power is and the imagination and the innovation, the creativity and the energy is always going to come from social movements. But we cannot make structural change without partners within the electoral sphere. And so, you know, that's where I've ended up. I'm not certain about anything. This is a hypothesis. We're all on a journey to try to figure out how to make our lives most meaningful. And this is I'm giving this a shot. I'm going to run again in the next federal election. I'm thinking of looking at other places to run as I'm moving into the city of Vancouver with my family in the next few months. And I'm really excited, although it's a terrible time to be in politics, I'm excited to try to play this role. It is scary, though, you know, like you look at some of the things that politicians are saying today about the death threats, about the hate,
yep,
about this populist right culture that is really threatening. So it's a scary time, but we are called. So I'm in.
I think people are absolutely feel good and hopeful that you will continue to be part of that sort of outside in, you know, that you will be part of that bridge that so is needed, especially in these times where people feel so cynical about electoral politics. So I think that's wonderful to hear, and I'm glad you will continue on that journey. So, Abby, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. It's really been inspiring to hear what you're up to, and I just want to say, just carry on, will you? thank you for talking to me today.
It's always a pleasure, Libby. Thank you so much.
That was Libby Davies in conversation with Avi Lewis. Thanks so much for that, Avi and Libby. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news. On Wednesday, students at the University of Ottawa and McGill University in Montreal both chose to end their months-long encampment protests. However, both groups vowed to continue the fight to get their schools to divest their financial support of Israel as the war against Palestinians in Gaza continues. Earlier this week, The Lancet issued a report where they estimate that as many as 186,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed by the Israeli military since October of 2023. This does not count the decades of oppression that Palestinians have faced at the hands of the Israeli government, which continues to confiscate and occupy more and more Palestinian land in the West Bank. The University of Windsor student encampment managed to reach an agreement with the university, where the school agreed to disclose its investments and declare Israel as an occupying power. In labor news, last Friday, more than 9,000 Liquor Control Board of Ontario, or LCBO, workers began strike action against the liquor retailer. The union representing striking workers has said privatization is one of the key issues that led the workers to strike. Earlier this year, Ontario Premier Doug Ford announced a plan to expand the availability of alcoholic beverages in grocery stores and convenience stores. Under this plan, eligible grocery and big box stores will be able to sell beer, cider, wine, and ready-to-drink beverages by the end of October. The Ontario Public Service Employees Union, which represents the striking LCBO workers, opposed this plan and said it would take revenue away from much-needed public services. And finally, Justice for Migrant Workers is calling for immediate action from the province of Ontario to better protect agricultural workers from extreme heat events this summer. Farm workers are 35 times more likely than the general public to die of heat exposure. The Ontario Human Rights Commission has stated that access to cooling is a human rights issue and that people with disabilities, Black, and low-income community members are disproportionately affected when heat waves and other heat events occur. Justice for Migrant Workers is calling on the provincial government to ensure that agricultural workers have access to shade, adequate breaks, water, and fair wages. As always, you can read all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
In 2024, many indie news media organizations are making the hard decision to close up shop. But with your support, Rabble.ca can continue to share news for the rest of us for years to come. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on YouTube. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your local radio station? It's easy. For more information, get in touch with me, Brianne Doyle, at brianne@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hey,